Good morning, everyone, and good morning to all of our nice friends here.
Good morning, good morning, Mrs. Webb.
We have a real opportunity this morning. We're bringing you a story by transcription, our date, rather, this morning, because actually we're sitting out in the very beautiful property of Oak Haven, right out here at the southern tip of Minnesota. If there is a tip, I guess it isn't really. It's straight line, isn't it? But we're at the 5th annual Silver Lake Writers Conference out at the Dr. Coleman residence here in Fairmont. And we have sitting around the table with us here in the living room some of our friends who have been here for the Writers Conference. So I know right now you'd like to meet them. And I think I'll ask Dr. Coleman as our host to introduce our friends and tell us from where they come. Would you do that?
I'd be very glad to. On my left is publisher M.D. Willis of Beacon House, Sioux City, Iowa, who issues manuscripts and plays for the high school market. And on my right is Dr. Gerald Villan, a writer, author, and teacher of Minneapolis, recently of the faculty of the University of Minnesota, who has now been appointed to the Farley Dickinson College in New Jersey. He's a short story specialist. Going on around the circle is our poet Ray Smith, who has lectured before a great many groups. After the Second World War, he was recognized as Lieutenant Ray Smith, an author of No Eclipse, one of the best collection of poems that came out of our recent war. Last year, he lectured at the Whitman Centennial on the spirit of Whitman today. And the next one in our group is a young, ambitious poetess, June Checkland, who won the Harper's Scholastic Poetry Prize in 1941, the national prize contest for the best poem. The poem is called Autumn Quietude. Our other leaders are not here at the present.
And so
one is in our cabin, a little indisposed.
Well, that's too bad. So we see we've gone around the circle, and here is your circle, A. Webb, and we're ready to talk with our friends about, well, how about it, as you, we hope you're sitting there having a cup of Harvest Queen coffee with us this morning. And is there any one of you who's wanted to write? And I'm sure there are many of you. As you've sat down, you think, well, now surely I can write that poem or that story that I've had in mind. Well, you see, today as we're sitting here talking with our people who are at the Silver Lake Writers Conference, we can talk about writing from all angles, because we have our pupils who are just starting, we have our young writers, we have the instructors, and we have someone who publishes or will buy that story or that play after you write it. So let's start in first with the problem of, well, the problem of the writer himself. I guess we better start there. Why don't you get the discussion started for us, Mr. Willen?
Well, the writer in America, it seems to me, is in a fairly precarious position. And I know that perhaps the publisher here is liable to disagree with me. But it seems to me that the writer today, or at least the writer who is interested in serious writing, has the problem of publishing to contend with. I'm interested primarily in the short story, and I find that there are fewer and fewer outlets for the serious short story. The consequence is that more and more writers are still born, it seems to me. And the future, well, I suppose I can be sound alarming, the future seems rather dim.
You mean that the publisher has such set rules, or what? Why should there be such a problem about getting something published?
Well, I really don't understand that problem myself. I think that perhaps the movies, this is a favorite theory of mine, that the movies and now television have made such inroads, first on the good writers in the country, and second on the time of the potential audience, that the writer is, the writer of short stories, is up creek, so to speak.
The writer's too exhausted to write, and the consumer is too busy watching television to read.
Right, right.
Don't you think that the problem of theme enters in there a lot, Jerry? It seems to me that the writing of the 30s, the books like The Grapes of Wrath, were probably more widely read and had a more direct bearing on the life of the people of the 30s than the novels that we've had since World War II. And I wonder if part of the problem isn't that the American writer has been increasingly interested in form and in formalism to the exclusion of dealing with the great basic issues. We don't get any longer the Okies and the Dust Bowl, it seems to me, but a few people talking in a room about a very cultivated subject. And I don't think that that provokes large.
I think that that's quite true,
audience.
But it's the result, I think, partly of the diminishing audience of the writer. So he has no one to talk to in a way but
it's
himself.
Reciprocal. Yes, it's reciprocal.
And in a way, the short story writer today is in very much the same position as the poet, who has not had an audience for a long time.
And poetry certainly is just a marginal activity for publishing houses. I'm sure you'd agree with that.
Is that right, Mr. Bullock?
That's right. If it's published at all, it's as a sort of a decoration or frosting on the trade and not for itself.
You said, Mr. Smith, you mentioned the basic issues and you mentioned the Okies. Well, now, there surely are still basic issues floating around this country, but that's it. We're just letting them float around and we aren't, and your writers aren't taking a hold of them because they feel there's no market, or what?
I think the problem is partly connected with the fact that writing has been so tied to the university, and I think that Mr. Willen agrees with me here. There's tended to be an academic kind of writing and an academic tone, and that this has constricted writing, and it's tended to make the writer imitate Henry James, for example, than go out and see what is happening in life in America.
Well,
writing about
again, that's the result of the restricted audience of the writer, because not being paid for what he does, he has to find an occupation which is congenial to him. Teaching or being in the academy is more congenial to most writers, or to many writers, than any other occupation. And the further the writer penetrates into the academy, I think the more esoteric writing is liable to become. And I speak as a writer who is in
the
academy.
That's a pretty big word there, Mr. Rowan, but it's all right.
Well, the less comprehensible, let's say, the writing is going to become to the potential reader.
Mm-hmm. Where in this picture does the Book of the Month Club come then?
Well, of course, there we have the publisher as the evil genius.
Yeah.
Because in his attempt to find books that are going to sell to the Book of the Month Club or the Literary Guild, he selects only those books, or mainly those books, which have a potential in that market. Although, certainly, the publisher takes other kinds of books, but I think now mostly for prestige reasons.
In other words, we aren't having something coming really from the heart of our people, like our original folk songs of centuries ago. Is that anything comparable there, or am I way off the beat?
I think that that's on the road of what I would say. It seems to me, again, that the problem isn't, as one writer said once about evil in politics, that it isn't a matter of Adam or Eve or the serpent, but it's the apple. And I think that the writer has lost sight of the apple today. He's so busy trying to copy or to fit into a certain kind of writing that's popular and that controls the little magazines which dominate literary standards. And I think that writing is always tied up with society. It's always tied up with the possibilities in society of expressing yourself. And since the war, there's been, I think, a false armistice in form. The writer has stopped trying to penetrate new forms, and he's tended to come to terms with forms that belong to the past, that have echoes of, for instance, in poetry, Georgian echoes, that is the poetry of World War I, which is relatively uncomplicated and simple and didn't deal with profound issues, and which has eventuated, to take one example, in the idea that there's no such thing as war poetry, which is a very prevalent critical idea today, in spite of the fact that people like Wilfred Owen wrote war poetry. But I think that's symptomatic.
And people like Ray Smith. We have the book right here, No Eclipse, War Poems by Ray Smith.
Well, it's notes. It's notes on poetry, at least.
I wouldn't say that. According to what
I,
you...
I would like to ask to hear June's reaction to what she feels is happening in literature here.
As you write, June, is that right? June Checkland, who is our young writer here. And has, what was that award that you won? Dr. Coleman told me?
Harper's Poetry Award for 1941.
Can you come up here just a little bit closer? Mm-hmm. Yes, can you? Do you want to talk about what the question Mr. Smith asked you?
Well, I'm inclined to agree with both Ray and Jerry. I think that the writers have gotten away from the mainstream of American life, possibly because... there hasn't been a mainstream of American life to go by for some time, at least that anyone has found.
Well, I was going to say, it sounds to me as if we're a little hidebound and a little tense, as if maybe we aren't... go ahead, what were you saying?
Well, the problem is so vexing that one hardly knows where to put his fingers on the whole
uh-huh.
thing. This much is apparent, that since the 20s, I would say, there have been practically no American writers to emerge. That is, who can compare with people like Faulkner, Hemingway, Fitzgerald, the poets Tate, Robinson, and whatnot. Well, what's the reason for that?
There's a tendency to decry the 30s, and yet it seems to me that two books that came out of the 30s, The Grapes of Wrath and Sandburg's The People Yes, are larger books and have more scope and more permanence. And the books have been written since World War II. And I keep coming back to that because it seems to me that on the 30s, literature was on the way in a sense that it's not on the way today. And by the way, I think it might be a good thing to say that in talking about writing, I think there should be a distinction made between so-called popular writing and what we're really concerned with, that is writing as an art. I mean, the effort of the artist to condense into some kind of enduring form.
And as an interpretation of the people.
Yes, what he sees mm-hmm. is important in life.
What are some of the basic issues that you think writers should be working with right now?
You mean me?
Yeah, any one of you.
That's a question that I've been asking myself for I don't know how many years now, and I just don't know how to answer it. I think that we're ripe for satire. On the other hand, the world situation is so precarious that I don't think that our country will stand for much satire. That is, there's a
and
theory...
And also the satirist
you
needs
mean,
a place
the
to
coffee
stand.
House or what?
He needs a place to stand that's pretty stable that he can look at society.
We need somebody like Swift to point out to us what our follies are. And yet, we are so insecure in the world as it is now that if a Swift were to emerge... he wouldn't get a hearing.
We just laugh at him.
Well, we wouldn't even get a chance to laugh at him, I think.
Contemporary satire, I suppose, is never approved by its own generation anyway,
well,
is that right?
Well, we have it in the movies. For instance, Charlie Chaplin, a great satirist, and look at what's happened to him.
Mm-hmm.
Barred from re-entering this country, and in general,
that's right.
An enemy of the country. And I think chiefly because he was a great satirist, and is a great satirist. And it's just something that in 20th century we can't stand, and yet which we need.
Well, that points back to the same thing we were just saying. It seems to me that the problem that we seem to be broaching here is that writing is under the control of formalism, and there's something in the direction of content that's necessary. That the writer has to take another look at America. He has to go outside the. University writing classes. He has to go into the South and see the developing social movements. He has to take another look.
Yet there is a large body of Southern writers.
Yes, the Southern Magnolia School, as someone called them.
Southern Magnolia School.
Do you think you are sufficiently decayed, as somebody wrote?
Mr. Willis.
I suppose the race issue would be, but that would all be so emotional, maybe, that we couldn't handle it. Is that right?
I think it would be very hard to handle it objectively.
Yes.
Here's my slant on the situation. I think our international situation and the tensions there, as well as our own local tension over the racial issues, have tended to make us intellectually stagnant.
Mm-hmm.
Period.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I don't know that we're intellectually stagnant. I think we're intellectually afraid.
Afraid to express.
Yes, and that fear has descended upon the writer.
Mm-hmm. And what the writer owes his living so much, the living that he gets, to usually to an academic job or something of that kind, that I think that even without his willing it, that he tends to curb what he does and to write in an approved kind of way.
I don't know whether the situation of a writer would be the same as an artist or not, and yet in some ways they are somewhat the same. But you know, you've heard the story about the young woman who spoke to Picasso, and she said, I'm beginning to see in nature all of these forms that you're painting right now. And Picasso said, oh, you mean nature's finally getting on the ball. So maybe that's the way our writers are fumbling around waiting for recognition. I don't know.
I think there's a good clue there in what you said. It seems to me that it's the lack of utopianism in writing today that's partly at fault, that the writer doesn't project any longer a large future view of society. Instead of that, he's content to, and feels that the proper subject matter is much more restricted. He doesn't write Moby Dick anymore, or Huckleberry Finn.
Mm-hmm. It sounds as if maybe, once in a while, we're a little bit too much concerned with the utopia of just our everyday existence, of how we move about the house and how easy our housework is and whether we have an air conditioner and all the rest of it. And still, it is mighty nice if we could just divorce ourselves from those appliances and all of the conveniences and go on with the creative thinking, just as our friends today are inspiring us as we talk with them here. But it is mighty nice to have those appliances around, and it is kind of a utopia when you realize that if you stop in at our Fredstrom's Town and Country store and ask to see that new Kelvinator freezer right now, you will find that you can't be undersold, because you can't be. If you stop in at Fredstrom's Town and Country store, you'll get the absolute low dollar, and you'll get, by buying now at Fredstrom's Town and Country store, an arrangement of terms that will fit your budget exactly as you want it. You can talk with Fritz there or any one of the boys. And remember, of course, you always get top Kelvinator quality. Kelvinator has only one quality, and that is the best. And at Fredstrom's Town and Country Store here in Fairmont, you can stop in and look at the Kelvinator freezer that you want. They're there in stock, and they're ready for delivery right now. So as you're going around the town of Fairmont, Minnesota this weekend, why don't you stop in at Fredstrom's Town and Country Store? It's just two doors north of the post office. And ask to see a Kelvinator freezer. Well, let's turn to our publisher. He probably has been sitting here with tongue in cheek, I don't know. Mr. Willis, the publisher of Beacon House from Sioux City, Iowa. What are some of your problems as you look for these, for our writers, and look to see whether they're bringing to your publishing house problems that you think would like to be sold, that our people would like to buy? That's a pretty involved question, isn't it? Well, you just take over.
Well, I think probably the main cause of our worry is that people who submit plays submit things that are not plays. They think they are. They're mere anecdotes written in dialogue form. They think they're plays.
All right. Well, what are you looking for then, Mr. Willis?
Well, we
take your second cup of Harvest Queen coffee. Now maybe you can sell something to Mr. Willis of the Beacon House.
specifically, we were looking for one-act plays for high school production. So they should be 30 minutes long, and plays that high schools would be proud to present.
Well, that's a moot question, too. Plays that high schools would be proud to present.
Perhaps I should say that there would be no characters in them that any of the students would object to playing. For instance, a seven-year-old child wouldn't come into a high school play very well. Other than children, most of them are able to cast their plays pretty well anyway. Mm-hmm. In fact, I think most of the instructors would rather have some characters in them for the students to portray, because it's good practice for them to take character parts.
Well, what do you think are some of the subjects that our high schools that would be good for them to portray?
Well, comedies they always want, and we seem to get more of those than we want. We would like to get some good 30-minute dramas. Up till now, we have one good one. The rest are all comedies.
Is that so? Right now, at this moment, down at Beacon House, huh?
That's right.
Well, there you are. So if you've been working away on a little one-act play that they're in the kitchen as you're drinking your Harvest Queen coffee, send it along. There may be a market for it, isn't that right, Mr. Willis?
There's definitely a market for it if it's if it's a good one-act play, running about 30 minutes in one scene only, and definitely in only one act.
Well, where do you, Mr. Willen, tell your, well, you don't tell them to go anywhere, especially to get subject matter. What do you do in a writing course to help our young writers, or
well, of course,
old writers, anyone?
I am one of the evil people that Ray Smith talks about, since I am either a victim of formalism or one of its exponents. So I say to my students that what is important is that they learn form first, how to structure a short story, the elements of conflict and things of that sort.
How do you structure a short story?
Well, discover where the conflict is, what the complications are, where the climax is to come, what the theme is going to be, and things of that sort. And I always tell my students that in any piece of writing, and this goes for a short story especially, there are two aspects. One is the subject, and then what the writer has to say about the subject, that is, his theme. And the two things have to be worked, it seems to me, simultaneously.
Should style evolve from the writer himself, or should Mr. Smith infers that there's too much copying of style, don't you? Didn't you infer that or not?
Well, I'm talking, I think we're a little at cross purposes here, because I certainly have nothing against teaching technique and writing, but the formalism that I was referring to, and that it seems to me is inhibiting writing in America in many respects, limiting it, is too great a dependence on the finished style of writers like Henry James. And I think that picking up almost any pocketbook of college writing will convince a person of that,
mm-hmm,
reading through it.
Well, I agree with you there that too much current writing, especially in the colleges, is stylized. And I don't think that the beginning writer ought to strive for style. He's going to get it eventually, if he keeps on writing.
Maybe it will evolve from his own personality and his own.
I think that what's most important for, or more important than style for a writer, is to find out, as Hemingway said, what he really thinks and feels, instead of dealing in terms of what he thinks he feels.
Mm-hmm. In other words,
what he is supposed to feel.
Yeah, what he's supposed to feel.
What he's supposed to feel.
In other words, the style may evolve not only from the personality, but from their experiences then.
Yes, and the writer has to come to terms with himself. He has to be honest with himself, find out what he believes in, what his philosophy is, and for that purpose, or those purposes, I think that going to school is very good.
Surely.
But I think now that the writer ought not to remain in school. He ought to get out.
All right, so there you are. If you have a conflict at home, follow its complications and decide when the climax is going to arrive, and you have a short story, don't they?
Well, if they can
write it. If they can put it together, that's right. Well, there's one part about style that affects every one of us gals every single day, of course, and that is just how you and I are going to look as we emerge from the house and go down the street, and how are you going to look for the 4th of July, which is coming right along right now. Well, Wolfs and Fairmont would like to remind us that with that 4th, next Wednesday, that's right, there's a wonderful, fun, full holiday, of course, for us, so let's be sure that we have everything in the style that we'll need, things, the kind of things you need to be comfortable, such as if you've got a good swimsuit, or got plenty of shorts around so you'll be comfortable, pedal pushers, nice cotton shirt to keep cool, sleeveless blouse maybe, sheer dresses, or shorty gowns and pajamas, if it's going to be cool enough so we can wear pajamas, regular length summer gowns and pajamas, slacks, anklets, knee-high hosiery maybe, or peds or footlets that you can slip on your feet if you don't wish to wear any stockings, some strapless bras for those sunback dresses, can-can petticoats for our full skirts, or regular slips, those from Wolfs and Fairmont, remember, with the no see-through for our sheath-lined dresses. And Wolfs and Fairmont would also like to remind us that we may need a new summer handbag now, maybe a pair of sheer white gloves or a perky new piece of summer jewelry to add a new touch to that outfit. We may want to replenish our Dorothy Perkins deodorant, perhaps, or get a new lipstick or face powder or bath oil or cologne. And on the street floor at Wolfs and Fairmont, there's a most complete selection right now of playtime, fun time, swim time wearing essentials for the children, too. And in Wolf's downstairs store, there are beach towels and terry cloth by the yard if you'd like to make up your own, cotton fabrics galore for sewing your own summer play or dress-up clothes. So be sure to shop at Wolfs and Fairmont, Right now, for all of the apparel, the sportswear, or accessory needs for yourself and the children for the grand and glorious Fourth and for that long summer that is still ahead of us. Before we have to say goodbye to our friends as we visit with them out here at Dr. and Mrs. Coleman's very lovely home, Oak Haven, at our Silver Lake Writers Conference, and this is the fifth annual one, by the way, as Dr. Coleman tells me, I know that since we mentioned that we do have our poet Ray Smith with us, I know that in our audience there are so many who would like to hear some of your poetry. Mr. Smith, would you consent to read one for us, or some? Or?
I'll read one moderately brief, I hope. And it's about a subject that everyone can write about, being my grandfather.
Oh.
After such fetes of light, now in the last slant of sun across plowed fields, over the damp landscape that he knew, a watery sun submerges, and through the rolling dusk, my mind retrieves this image out of a childhood October whose evenings are a breath forever lost. My grandfather, framed by an autumn day, surrounding the great pumpkin with his aged but wiry body, for the children then. Smells of the garden tagged him through the door. It seems his gift of all in that ripe hour, his farmer's body lifting from its toil, largesse of all he grew to a child's eyes. Boyhood that spied the spilling granary, sweet fruits of the apple tree, and walked beside him, lover of snuff and carpentry and bryon, on land he broke with oxen to the plow. I bear you like the folded seed of Eden, and over sunken indies of young hope, his gift shines yellow for a friendly earth, which knelt like a great dog under his hand.
Oh, that's a very sensitive picture. Childhood October. You know, it seems to me, as I grow older, that childhood Octobers were more beautiful. But the other day, a Mr. Duford from our university told me that I wasn't completely wrong, that we don't have flowers that smell anymore. We've gotten so that they're so...
Perhaps that's part of the writer's problem.
Maybe that's what's the trouble. We're not any good anymore. Because I didn't seem to me the roses smelled as good as they used to. It seemed to me that I was the only one that smelled from all the perfumes that I got, but that the roses doesn't smell. He said, that's the truth. Neither do the peonies. Did you know that?
Go down this where I walk and smell of those
out here
wild
at Oak Haven.
Those roses are great.
We have some old-fashioned white roses down.
You have that really have a delightful odor and fragrance, so that's wonderful. Well, of course, it's true that each one of us likes to smell like a lovely rose, too, and it's very easy to do if you stop in at Gardner's Pharmacy, where it's so much fun to shop because it's air-conditioned and cool and wonderful, and you'll feel like you want to go home and take that Risley bath soap home with you and have a nice, sudsy, comfortable bath. Remember that right now at Gardner's Pharmacy, these Risley bath soap specials, 8 wonderful, big, superb baths, bars of soap for only $1.98. They're regularly $3, remember. And they come in the 4 fragrances, apple blossom, pine, lilac, and bouquet. And then for the cleansing cream that you'll want to take along with you as you're on vacation, you can get Dewberry Cleansing Cream at Gardner's Pharmacy right now, the regular $2 bottle for only $1, and the Skin Freshener, the regular $1.75 size for just $1, and you'll look as if you were born beautiful. Would you consent to read another poem, Mr. Smith?
Well, I think I'd prefer if we talked a little more. I feel a little abashed to...
Well, you don't need to, because our friends like it.
I think we should say that it's a great shame that Mara de la Serre, one of the finest writers in the Middle West, is indisposed and can't be on the symposium, because she is a very valuable person, too.
I feel very bad about that. Maybe before she goes back, we can have a chance to chat with her a little bit over a transcription. Our time is just about up, however. And so maybe as Dr. Coleman extends an invitation to friends in this area or tells us about plans for a writer's conference, maybe you would look up one more poem for us, Mr. Smith.
Please go ahead.
Oh, we love them. I know you feel very reticent about it, of course.
Please go ahead here.
Go on, won't you?
If I have it here, I'd like to read instead something from Mara de la Serre, which I have always thought offered a kind of credo
for
the writer.
Just what we'll do.